2020. Today is the February 14th, 2024, Toledo Planning Commission. Right now I'm going to call to order, starting on the left. Roll call made by name.
Problem is.
Cora Warfield. Ann Ellis.
Ricky Dyson.
Dennis Sutherland.
Okay, and we note that Ruth Ann is going to be absent and Brian may show up. So with that, I will say that at this point we have no, and Brian has just showed up. If he wants to say he's here, that would work.
Brian Lutheran is here.
Okay, and we have no visitors, so that then that's takes care of that. And approval of the January 10th, 2024 minutes. Okay, so if nobody's seen any corrections, that has been moved by Ricky, a second.
I'll second.
Okay, and it's been seconded by Cora. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. It passes with the exception of Ruth Ann. Okay. And I don't know if Jonathan, since you weren't here, but that's okay. We'll never. Okay, so now we're going on to the training of Planning Commission and Land Use Basics. We were all handed a nice little thing here that was interesting to go through. And so we'll let that proceed on. I imagine we hand that over to staff, Justin.
Yeah, all right, thank you. And I'll share, you have the slides in front of you, but we'll share screen as well. But this is just something that we've done, try to do at least once a year. It's just a land use 101 training to kind of go back through kind of what the role of Planning Commission is and kind of the different types of hearings that might come forward to the Planning Commission. I'll try and run through it pretty quickly and then kind of take questions. If there's questions as I go, feel free to raise your hand. If not, we'll have time for questions at the end. But this is just a quick overview of the presentation, as you kind of saw on the slides, but history, kind of urban growth boundaries generally, the statewide planning goals, kind of who's who from the Planning Commission to the City Council, planning documents, zoning, the land use actions, and the type of hearings, and then just any questions at the end. So just some high-level history, kind of where Oregon really started zoning was from Senate Bill 100. There's zoning prior to 1973, but kind of Oregon's land use laws really came from Senate Bill 100 in 1973. So a lot of that was to protect farm and forest land outside of city limits and urban growth boundaries. As many of you know, Toledo, as other cities, has an urban growth boundary, which is kind of the bounds of our future development. And then everything outside of that is under county jurisdiction. And typically it's a farm or forest zone or an ag zone, or there's some rural residential zones, but they're larger lots than what's in the city. And so all of our development is bound to happen within our urban growth boundary. And our city limit line is a little bit inside the urban growth boundary. So any future annexations, kind of where those have to happen, are properties that are in the urban growth boundary and currently adjacent to city limits. You can't kind of leapfrog properties when you're annexing. The city has had a couple annexations in the last few years, but they kind of happen slowly in terms of annexation applications. And then I was kind of getting into this a little bit, but I guess this is a good way to describe it, where kind of development ends is kind of that edge of the urban growth boundary. It's not always such a clear-cut line as an example in the picture, but that's kind of the edge of urban development. There's also unincorporated areas, but those are kind of like rural communities that might appear as a city where they're a little bit smaller lots, but a lot of those are they don't they won't have a water sewer system. They'll still be on septic and well.
And they're under the auspice of the county, whatever
Under the
county
county
they're in.
jurisdiction, yeah. Just as many of you are now familiar with, since we recently completed our comp plan, Oregon's statewide planning goals, just for reference. We're not going to go through each of these today, but this is just kind of a reference of those 18 statewide planning goal or 19 statewide planning goals, and then kind of the ones that apply to the city are in bold. Citizen involvement. So we've talked about this a lot with our comp plan update, but it's the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. So it's you're as the planning commission, you are the citizen involvement committee for the city. And that's part of kind of the charge and role of the planning commission. And then we're gonna go through each of these for who's who in kind of the land use world. So the Department of Land Conservation and Development, that's our state planning agency. They do anything from creating the OARs updates. Recently, there's been housing code updates that have been required to kind of specifically around ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and we as a city, we follow and make those updates within our code. So whenever there is an OAR update from DLCD, from a legislative change or something, then the city will follow and update codes. They regulate comp plans, so through our comp plan process, we submitted to DLCD for review. And they re regulate urban growth boundaries. So if we were ever to change our urban growth boundary, we'd have to be in compliance with DLCD rules, the OARs, and they would review that. They can also provide technical assistance, and they have some grants. And then our regional rep is Brett Estes, and I think he's attended a couple of meetings over the last couple of years, but he's kind of our primary DLCD contact with questions. So city staff kind of do current planning, just the day-to-day planning. If someone comes in with questions on a property, setback questions, and then comp planning is more of that long-range planning that we worked on. And then also public outreach through advisory groups or planning commission, city council, or just general public outreach as well. So city council, that's the elected body, and they appoint planning commission members after you apply to be on the planning commission. They work they hire the city manager, so that's currently Doug Wiggins, who attended one planning commission meeting and will periodically be at planning commission meetings. They direct staff on projects, initiate plan updates, and they will make some land use decisions. So I'll kind of go over that in more detail. Planning Commission has that authority in some cases, and City Council has others. So you're, as the Planning Commission, you're advisory to the City Council. You'll make land use decisions. I'll go into that more. And then you'll also make recommendations to the City Council. The Land Use Board of Appeals, so this is the body that are, if there was ever an application at the city that got appealed from Planning Commission to City Council, and then again it was appealed at the City Council level, then it goes up to the Land Use Board of Appeals for review. So that's a specific court for land use cases. So they specialize in Oregon in land use cases. There's a whole bunch of case law that's available online from the
So,
yeah.
so LUBA is three generally attorneys appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They've got an office in Salem. Anything that's considered land use in the state statute gets appealed the city and county generally have two bites of the apple, right? The planning commission, then the city council on appeal. So the city has two bites to get it right, and then it goes to LUBA. Nothing land use goes into the circuit court, into the county, Lincoln County Circuit Court, or any other circuit court in the state. And then from there, it gets from LUBA, it gets appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals. So I think that they just made the decision to, so much land use going on, not to bog down the circuit courts, the lower state courts. So,
and they're able to specialize in land use cases.
Yeah,
so you're not going to a random judge that doesn't specialize in land use. I think they ended up in the 70s and 80s when the system first was created. There was a lot of appeals, and they got
it was 73 when it passed, and then in 6 years, all of the 70 appeal process shows up.
But yeah, I like Mike's point that two bites at the apple, because if something ever was appealed at Planning Commission, we kind of have the ability to update our staff level findings or add detail or refine things so it could be approved at city council level and maybe not appealed. But there's some cases where if there's a neighbor that just disagrees with the decision, they will take it to city council and then LUBA as part of the process. And one thing I guess to clarify here is when an application's appealed, it has to be based on the criteria in the code. So it can't.
About the evidence of that particular hearing also?
Mm-hmm. And they have to present evidence that's related to a criteria and define specifically what criteria they're appealing on and provide the evidence of why.
Or the lack of evidence, and you were biased because you made the comment X. Anyway, I think you'll get into.
And then so
later. I have a question. So, like, when it gets appealed like that, would we have to go to court?
It's totally based on the record. It's totally based on the evidence in the record, whether it's written, whether it's the recording. And often in those LUBA briefs, you quote the record and you try to find evidence that was presented that can go toward that point. And that's the importance of creating a record. You know, that's the importance of sitting on the planning commission and say, well, we got to consider criteria A, and this is the criteria. And these are the things, you know, this testimony and that testimony and, you know, the staff report, they address this. And I think A is met. And then, you know, criteria B, I think B is met. So if you create, you know, you can really help in a LUBA appeal by making a clean record.
And isn't that what the green sheet says, that you have to be present at the hearing to make an appeal, correct? And you have to do it within.
So if they don't, come
to the hearing,
they don't come to the hearing.
Yeah.
So like generally that's definitely the rule. You might get attorneys argue slightly something different, but yeah, I mean, I've submitted testimony at the county planning commission, at the county commissioners, so that I can go to LUBA but I've done that as county attorney too, and seen that. And you know, you don't have standing if you haven't.
Yeah.
You don't have a dog in the fight. You haven't raised the issue at the lower level.
Yeah, I think there could be an instance where it's written comments in the record, but
you can definitely, and I did that to the county planning commission. I didn't actually go. I submitted written records and confirmed with the planning staff that those would be entered into the record,
into that hearing,
and then I didn't bother, and then I went to the county commissioners. But yeah, it can definitely be written. It's written or verbal.
And that's why we do our best at, when we do receive comments, to try and make sure they're in the record. If we get them ahead of time, we'll provide the packet and then try to address those comments as well. It's kind of when we get an application, we ask for the applicant to provide narrative in alignment with the criteria, and then it's best if someone is going to appeal or submit testimony that testimony is also kind of follows the same format. But it's not always the case that we get a nice narrative that's aligned, but we'll include the comments in the record. We've had cases where the comments aren't really related to the criteria, but then there are cases where they are specifically outlining kind of here's our concerns and why it's related to the criteria. And we'll get into this a little bit more later in the presentation too. And so citizens, so this kind of there is the key, one of the key components of the Oregon land use system is citizen involvement, kind of providing public testimony at both all types of hearings, participating in public outreach, like with the comp plan, we had a survey that went out. We tried to do tabling events as well across the city, and that required participation from the citizens. And then kind of ultimately everyone here and on the city council is a citizen of the city. And then just, this is real high level, just different plans that we have. As you know, that kind of some of them are older, but we have kind of a new comp plan. And something potentially that we're looking at doing here is having a parks, applying for a parks plan, parks master plan for the city through an Oregon Parks and Rec grant. So there's potential there to update that plan, and the planning commission would be involved in that process. And that would also have some citizen involvement, community outreach. So we're hoping to, that application is not due until around May of this year, but that's something that we're looking at possibly applying for. And that would kind of inventory existing parks, provide ideas for funding of those parks into the future, and just different capital projects, and assign a cost estimate to those. Because right now we don't have a master plan, so sometimes it's hard to think about what's the priority, how do we prioritize our projects, and that will help with that. And just land use actions. So land use decisions are defined in ORS 197. I don't have that cited or quoted here, but kind of this, everything that falls under that ORS is kind of what ends up ultimately would be in LUBA if something was appealed. So final decision that concerns the adoption, amendment, or application of statewide planning laws, a comp plan provision, a land use regulation, or a new land use regulation that requires the use of discretion. So these are legislative. So legislative decisions are like the comp plan update that was just completed, and quasi-judicial, that would be a conditional use or a variance application that the planning commission reviews. Ministerial, those are staff level type approvals. So in the code, we have site plan reviews. So making sure setbacks are met, making sure height is met, and that's what would fall under ministerial. And kind of, sorry, I got into this a little too early, but these are the administrative, are also, these are often considered type one procedures. So these are kind of, I guess a good way to put it is site specific, and they're clear and objective. So it's a measurement standard that's, if the front yard setback is 15 feet, the site plan would have to indicate that when it's submitted, and then we would review that and make sure it meets the required setback. And then side yards height, kind of similar. And then, yeah, these are all staff level reviews. So quasi-judicial, these are type 2 and type 3. So type 2 are staff level approval, but we know there's notice to neighbors required. Those might be some minor variances. And then type three, as I mentioned, those are conditional uses, variances, that notice to neighbors, and then Planning Commission is the review body for those type three. So these are generally initiated by a property owner. So if a property owner wants to have a certain use that's not permitted but allowed through a conditional use, they would have to apply, submit an application, submit materials, a site plan, and all the information that we need to address the criteria and kind of know what's proposed. So that the property owner has to sign it and initiate that process. Sometimes it might be that if it's a business owner and it's a different property owner, essentially both parties would just have to sign that application. So that also happens quite frequently if it's a commercial tenant that's trying to get a certain use. And these have to result in a decision. So there has to be a final decision. It could be approval with conditions is most often what we'll see kind of with our conditional uses. There's a set of conditions that will come with that they have to meet. And then denial is kind of the third primary option. And then, as I mentioned, those are the pre-existing criteria that we have to review. So for a certain conditional use or a certain variance, it's all set. It's already been set, and that's what we have to look at or reviewing. And then these do involve the discretion by the decision-making body. So that's part of the reason why we have a planning commission, is to review the facts and determine if that criteria is being met. Staff will write initial findings, and then planning commission can review those, help add to those, add comments to the record. We do our best to put everything in the staff report, but there's some things that will often come up during the meeting that need to be addressed. Next, so legislative, these are type four hearings. So this is like a future law, policies, or regulations. So the comp plan update, new updating our housing code, that's a legislative update. And then these, planning commission is making a recommendation to city council that makes the final decision in legislative hearings. So just real quick, kind of a work session. So this would be considered a work session. This is kind of just a committee meeting held for the purpose of determining the contents of a measure. It's different than a public hearing. We're not taking testimony, although the public may attend, and the chair in certain instances could allow public comment during work session, but we're not deliberating to a decision. So we'll have work sessions as we're talking through the subdivision and partition code, but we're not making a final decision that will come when there's the final public hearing process. And then I've talked about this a little bit, but kind of each application has those specific criteria that have to be addressed. So if the applicant demonstrates compliance with the criteria, the application must be approved, even if the body doesn't agree with the criteria. And then if the applicant fails to demonstrate compliance with the criteria, the application must be denied. And that's if there's a case where there's disagreement with the criteria, that's where we would have to go through a legislative amendment and later on update that criteria. So it's better kind of, we can better evaluate future applications. So there, in that instance, that would be kind of, if there's a quasi-judicial conditional use in front of you that has to be approved, but you don't agree with it, we'd have to come back later. We'd have to approve it if they meet the criteria. We can come back later and update the criteria through a legislative update. If that all makes sense, it's a lot. But that's the only way to change that criteria is through the legislative Type 4 update. And so findings, these are statements of how each criteria has satisfied, is satisfied by the facts. It ensures that the criteria is being applied, and the reasons, the facts support the decision based on the relevant criteria. And then they have to address all of the criteria. So they can't just pick and choose, but if all of the language is that and then all of those criteria would have to be met. There are certain instances where the code will say or, so then in that instance, there is a kind of, they would have to meet one or the other criteria, kind of depending. And then, so evidence, the applicant has the burden of proof, so they have to submit an application package. And that's why we encourage also applicants to attend the meetings if there's questions about the proposal from planning commission members. So most of the time I would say we get applicants to attend. There's certain instances where they don't, but for the most part, I would say they do, and they're able to kind of answer questions that the planning commission does have for clarification. Decision has to be made based on the evidence in the record. So that could be the written application or the verbal evidence that's provided as well. So substantial evidence is a reasonable mind could accept as adequate to support the decision. I know it's a little wishy-washy language there, but they have to submit enough to where the planning commission feels comfortable that criteria is met. And then if there's conflicting, there could be conflicting evidence based on different data. So I guess one example could be, I'm trying to think of an example ahead of time. Let's say an applicant submitted a geotech report into the application, but then a neighbor submitted a separate geotech report that had different evidence and findings. So that would be considered conflicting evidence that the planning commission would have to evaluate in that instance.
Or dueling surveys of the same property line.
Yeah, that's another good example.
Old property deeds.
Yeah. 100 years old.
Not like that old. We want to go back to 1894.
So the decision, it's so for conditional use, you'd have approval with conditions, and then denial. And I'll get into the rational nexus and roughly proportional here. So this came out of case law, so the Nolan and Dolan cases. So rational nexus is between the condition and the applicable regulation, and that there is a legitimate public purpose for the condition. So when we're writing conditions, they have to have that. First, they have to meet the nexus test. So we can't condition that someone plants street trees across the entire city for their conditional use application. It has to be related to the proposal. So a condition might be sidewalks in front of the property if there's not sidewalks, or sidewalk improvements or street trees along the frontage of that specific lot or property as part of the conditional use. So it's connected to, there's that nexus to the proposal. And then Dolan is it has to be reasonably proportional. So between the exaction and the condition based on individualized determinations of the property's impact. An example here would be if conditional use came in and then the city required a stoplight at a nearby intersection that wasn't in front of it. There would have to be a determination that that use is creating enough trips to justify the stoplight. If it's not reasonably proportional, then it wouldn't meet this test. So if it's a small use where there's only, say, 10 trips a day, it's not generating a lot of traffic, it probably wouldn't meet the reasonably proportional. But if it's a giant big box store, like a Walmart or Fred Meyer or something like that, then the city often has the ability to require a adjacent light. It's maybe not right next to the property line, but it's kind of the key intersection associated with the use. So those are kind of just general examples, but that's kind of where we have to make sure when we're writing those conditions, that they're not random and they're connected to the project. So I think most often you'll see the sidewalks, street trees, like general ones, like making sure there's easements if they're required as part of the project. Seeing a fence, I think, has been a part of a conditional use that's been a condition. Those are just general ideas of what the conditions could be, and actually our code outlines generally what the Planning Commission could condition as part of it. The public hearing, that's on, Anne gets the green sheet with all the specific language that we have to read. There are options where there could be a continuance to the next hearing where the process would restart, or if the record is requested to be left open, we would have to leave the record open for at least 7 days. And then the reviewing body must allow the applicant at least 7 days after the record is closed to all other parties to submit kind of the rebuttal arguments. And then it would come back. At the next scheduled meeting. And then, so there's a 120-day rule. So this rule is essentially to ensure that we're making land use decisions in a reasonable manner in terms of we're not holding up someone longer than necessary. So we have a 120-day rule. We're allowed to take 30 days for a completeness check. So if someone submits a conditional use and they didn't sign the application, they didn't provide any sort of narrative, we would write a letter back saying that it's incomplete, and the clock at that time, it's not started yet. Once it's deemed a complete application, that's when the clock starts. But we would still have to submit a letter to the applicant saying that it's incomplete within that 30-day timeline. In certain cases, we can ask the applicant to waive the 120-day rule. So that would allow it to be longer than 120 days, but the applicant would have to agree to that.
I was wondering about that. What would the purpose of that be? To the city?
If there's a couple continuances.
Maybe they heard testimony that they want to, you know, that, well, if I had my survey by now, it might clear up that, you know, it might be evidence in my favor to clear up that issue. And, you know, sometimes they decide they want to ask for a continuance to delay it.
Yeah, and if we aren't able to meet the 120-day rule, maybe it results in a denial because we don't have all the information we need, because we don't want to get to the point where the clock runs out, because then they can ask for that writ of mandamus, which basically is saying they can proceed without final local government approval.
And that court is LUBA. I was wondering which court gives the writ of mandamus.
That's a good question.
Well, I worked on a writ of mandamus dealing with measure, what was it, 37? Uh-huh. You know, which was compensating property owners for land use decisions that changed what they could do before, and we did it directly to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
In part because. And the reason we did that was because even though Measure 37 dealt with land use decisions, the legislature said it's not a land use decision because they didn't want it in LUBA, they wanted it in the circuit court. And so I don't know. I think LUBA could probably do a writ of mandamus.
But that's Stan.
But the writ of mandamuses that I've done have been in circuit court.
Okay.
And it's the, you know, the local government made the wrong decision.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and ultimately, our goal is not to get to the point where we're
near
the 120-day rule. I would say most of our decisions are within 60 or so days, and depending on the timing of when someone submits. We have to send out the public notice for 15 days to neighbors. So, but if they submit right after, or if they submitted this week, that would kind of extend the timeline because the next planning commission isn't for a while longer, but we're definitely usually more in the 60-day range, which allows for if there's a continuance or an appeal. And that's the other tricky part, is it's not just the planning commission decision, it's the final local decision. So that would include the appeal to city council. So that's kind of why we build in that extra time and try and get the planning commission date as soon as possible. So that's everything. I did want to give Mike, if you wanted to talk about bias and ex parte contacts. I didn't have a slide for that, but
yeah. I probably have a slide deck somewhere. I'm just not sure where it is.
We can go over it next time too.
So ex parte contact is, and bias, things that you probably, conflicts of interest or things that you want to disclose. I think the chair's green cheat sheet asks for those three things. But conflict of interest, if you or a member of your family or a business that you or a member of your family are a part of are going to be impacted by this, you know, if it's your uncle that has an LLC that shows up and you know he's the neighbor and it's going to negatively impact him, he's giving testimony, you should disclose that. Come talk to me beforehand and we can figure out what the conflict of interest is and what you whether you should not participate at all. Sometimes you can declare a conflict of interest, which a conflict of interest, an actual conflict of interest, the statute uses the different shall and may terms, and an actual conflict of interest is shall impact you financially or avoid financial detriment. And the may is, it may, you know, possible, but you definitely want to look at, am I going to be impacted by this decision, and think about that and disclose it if you will be impacted. Bias, you'd be amazed at what in private practice and as a county attorney, the comments by planning commissioners that attorneys would, you know, as a Linn County deputy attorney, you know, working in the DA's office, I was doing the civil stuff for the county, and every decision we made would be appealed by Linn County, by friends of Linn County. Just didn't matter if it was the organization or the individual that ran the organization. And I did a lot of LUBA responses and argued at LUBA. And, you know, if you just don't want to make any statements that'll indicate that you're biased. And I guess kind of along those lines, ex parte contact is kind of related. You know, have you went and visited the site? Have you went and talked to the applicant? do you have inside information that you're making your decision on that the other members of the planning commission do not? So, you just say, yeah, I went out and looked at it. And somebody else will say, yeah, I went out and looked at it. That's fine. Then you go on and make your decision. But I getting a letter from the applicant because they're your friend or an email asking you to make a decision, and you've got all that inside information and not disclosing that to the rest of the planning commission, you don't want to do that because it's going to impact the city's decision and may result in decision getting overturned. But bias sometimes, I'd expect all hippies to have, or whatever, I'd expect all lefty environmentalists to think, you just want to keep all of that out of the record. Because attorneys will look at that and say, well, that, whatever decision, it could be an elected official, it could be, the mayor coaches basketball, so he's inclined to find with the school district. I mean, there may be nothing there, absolutely nothing, but they'll claim it. So just kind of do what you can to avoid.
Don't throw them crumbs.
yeah. Don't throw them the crumbs. I don't know if there's any questions about any of those three things. But the conflict of interest is probably the biggest one.
One time you stepped down.
I stayed home from a meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not that there, I don't know if there would have been a conflict, but
yeah.
I just mm-hmm. felt that.
Yeah.
Quite often we have a case where I've done it myself. Mm-hmm. You go out and look at the property. Well, you've got to say that you've gone out and looked at the property.
Yeah.
Because, maybe the property owner comes up to you and says, what are you doing? Well, better declare it.
Yeah.
Well, I always thought it was a good idea to go look at the park property anyways. Yeah, but then, I think that we're allowed to look at it, but we can't go on the property itself. If I remember correctly,
you don't want to go on private property.
You can drive by and look, and the owner's press. Permission. You could turn around in the driveway or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't recommend that drive by or
so who's the boots on the ground for the planning commission?
So the
yeah no the, so you're saying you don't recommend drive
no by? I said you can drive by don't go on the private property.
Go to look in their windows.
Yeah. But in terms of boots on the ground, you're it's very common for planning commissioners to drive by a site. It's just that it needs
off on the permit
to declared. And then separately staff will drive by sites as well to view the site.
I'm assuming somebody goes on there and signs off to approve of what they've said they did on the paperwork or going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, setbacks yeah. And with conditional uses, we'll follow up on those conditions to make sure that they're meeting those. So like one example would be if like Public Works had a specific water sewer connection condition that was put into the application, or fire had that there needs to be a fire turnaround or something. There we'll go out and once they're building, make sure that they're meeting that condition.
I remember a fellow by the name of Lee Humphreys, I believe.
Yeah.
He used to come around there anytime somebody was doing anything, he'd come and inspect it. And is that not the way it is anymore?
For so we
Was he the building inspector?
He inspected everything.
He inspected our house.
You know, he was putting something new in or whatever.
He's probably the building inspector, which we don't have a building inspector on staff at the city. We contract with the county.
So,
and that guy's name's John Rodriguez right now.
So, but nobody,
I don't know,
inspect anything that goes on.
They'll inspect. We, as the city, we're not the ones. And the, so our building official, his name is John Robinson, so, or Rodriguez, sorry. He's the one that will go out and inspect for building code. And that's regardless of not just conditional uses or land use applications, but for new homes. He's the one that's going out and inspecting those. From the city side, we'll inspect from the outside of a property, but we're not going inside new homes.
Right.
And we'll
Check for setbacks and stuff like that.
And unless you're the fire will go in for fire life safety, do inspections.
Mm-hmm.
But the city staff's inspecting for the land use criteria, not, you know, building code criteria.
Like our last meeting, we had a guy put in for a couple lots and got a survey done and stuff. And mm-hmm. did anybody go out and check all that? And
so in those instances, we'll drive by the outside of the site, but we're in that case, we are relying on the survey's information. And there in that survey that you're referencing was actually the Leitner one, and it was, they recorded it. Mm-hmm. So it's now recorded. And basically what we do as staff is we make sure what they provided to Planning Commission is the, not necessarily always exactly the same, but substantially the same. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it might be a couple of feet off, but that's substantially the still two parcels, they're still approximately the same size. That's what we're checking through the survey process.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an instance where, yeah, that's what we're looking at.
But we still don't know where at on that parcel he's putting them at yet.
We know the parcels layout, but we don't, I mean, we know the, at this point, there wasn't a home location. There's an approximate home location. So we haven't inspected that yet.
Because I have seen that property because I own the property quite a bit around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's all been pushed around the dirt. So any field's going to be 3 years before you can build on it. So I don't know if that's the grade he's picking or he's going to have it cut the grade, or I don't know. I didn't know if anybody had looked at that or not. So
no, and we're I'm not sure because we still haven't received a home permit yet in terms of, because it could be, sometimes we get partitions and someone's coming in
right
the next week and wants to build already, and sometimes it's 10 years down the road.
In Lincoln County, you can't build on fill for 3 years, but I don't know where his houses are going. So
yeah, and through the building permit side, they do have the mm-hmm. compaction sure. requirements. And that's another one where we do rely on our
Because last time on the county, two squares on a piece of blank paper and one flag lot and one square, so no idea where that lies.
Yeah,
on their property.
Yeah, and I don't know where the final.
Yeah,
exactly where it will be on the lot.
So.
That would be an interesting thing to know because I wasn't aware of that. That when you have to fill. Sometime when we have enough, that's an interesting, the building thing itself. So that's.
It'll generally go within about a foot and then final grade will come later. But I don't know where, there was a lot of cat work done, but I didn't know where.
Yeah, I'm just saying just in general, that general principle, for the county and the city regarding fill and compacted land.
That might even not be where he's going to build, but it looked like the whole place was done in cat work, so. I was wondering who did the boots on the ground work there. So
yeah, and that's where we do rely on the county. We also,
and I didn't see any survey marks or signs or anywhere. It's not on the three sides I own.
Okay,
so I left one more side, and I didn't see any.
And we have an excavation fill permit through the Public Works Department. Mm-hmm. So if someone is,
I didn't look very hard.
The minimum.
One of my traders out.
Yeah. Anything over 50 cubic yards, somebody should be getting a permit with the city, and the Public Works reviews those permits. So that's kind of one catch. But if it's a small amount, it might not require. That's kind of the city side capturing. In terms of building code, we rely on the building official for the compaction requirements, making sure that they meet those.
I mean,
we don't have those.
Expertise. Yeah, it might not even be degraded yet. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's why I was asking who's boots on the ground so I could ask them that stuff.
In that case, it would be the building official for any compaction. Once there gets to the point where they're mm-hmm. submitted a home. But that's not, that portion isn't a part of the compaction piece. Is that part of the zoning review? I know it gets complex. We would review though if there's that Public Works review, if there's the excavation fill that's occurring prior and they're doing more than if they're, and then also if they start to cut into slopes, significant slopes over 25%.
Yeah.
That's where we're.
Jerry, most of the time, they like to look at the vegetation before they start looking at stuff, but he's hooked up to city water, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they'll have to connect the city water sewer.
Well, yeah, because it runs through my properties.
Yeah, in that case, the connection should be easy for him.
Yeah, so, it's all downhill. So,
yeah.
Thanks.
I know those are good questions. We try to. Our best to be kind of boots on the ground review, but then we also are relying on our partners for some of that review, partners internally and externally. Whether it be fire or Public Works, also on the ground on the site.
Sure.
Any other questions on the training?
Thank you.
That's it. High level update, and hopefully it helps when we have our first conditional use or variance or whatever it happens to be when that comes. And then also I'll say when we, Anne, you confirmed this last year, and I think you want to step down after this year as the chair.
Yeah, it'd be fine.
Yeah. So if someone's kind of thinking about it, if they want to step into the chair position in July.
It's a comfortable chair. Yeah. It's really comfy, folks.
And just reach forward with your right hand and go like that.
There you go.
No. The right there, grab the gavel.
Oh, this one?
No, the big one. Yeah. The big one. And hand it to your right.
To the right, the gavel.
The person that has the next amount of experience.
Yes, but that's to the left.
My right. No wonder you're.
I could just fill it up in the air.
Everybody's like, no, don't pick me.
Just throwing it out. It's 4 or 5 months away, but still on people's radar. the next agenda item is kind of, this is the next step where. Last time we generally talked about some code updates, but this is a code audit that was previously done that talks about some specific section recommendations for updates. Here we're mostly focused on the Title 16, so anything Title 17 were less applicable to our updates. But this is generally what staff's going to do is take some of these recommendations and other things we've heard from property owners, and DLCD staff, and take our code and do text edits based on that. And ultimately our goal is to make the partition and subdivision process smoother for property owners and create standards that you still have efficient use of land. So it's not like we're not taking the standards away, but we're trying to still have efficient use of the land within the city But also making it so that it's possible to divide property if it makes sense within the city. So kind of some updates are kind of simple, like updating the title is the first recommendation here. But then there's other updates where we'll have to look at our density standards. Like this isn't something we've actually had to use recently because we haven't had those come into play with our subdivisions. We haven't had our recent subdivision, but that's something that we can relook at to make sure the density standards would still make sense for the city. Yeah.
On the 1604 general provisions where it says 50% maximum and 80% minus constrained lands, is the constrained lands, is that like referring to the 25% slope? Because the difference isn't that much. It's only 10% what they're recommending, 70%. So I didn't know what constrained lands.
Yeah, constrained lands in the code, it could be anything from wetlands, it was 25% slopes.
Okay.
I think natural hazard. There's a few things listed, but probably most applicable would be wetlands or 25% slopes. But the goal of that is to make sure that when someone does divide their land, they're doing it in an efficient way, that there's at least a level of density, because we only have so much land within our urban growth boundary, but then there would still be individual lots where someone could build a single family home, but it's kind of balancing, you know, we only have so much land left and we need to meet density standards. But that's something where we haven't had to apply those since I've been here, and we haven't had a subdivision in a long time in the city. So that's one that it might take a little more thought, because it's easy for us once we've seen like a partition come in and we see, oh, this standard's really creating problems, versus kind of if here we have to kind of think about, okay, well, what if someone did divide their land, what it would look like, is this going to create a problem? And the increase is to try and increase that level of density. But I would, before we change that, I would want to kind of run some scenarios of what that look like in terms of calculations. And there are actually some in the code, there are some examples where it's like, this is a 25 acre lot, this much of it's constrained, and it runs through what that calculation would look like. I don't have all that off the top of my head right now, but once we get into the code text edits, that's something that we can look at.
Well, and didn't we at one time have that possibility when that property on Arcadia Drive came up, weren't they talking about putting in multifamily and some single family kind of on that other side of the road there?
Yeah, there's two.
The west side.
Yeah, on the west side.
Those are kind of that one and then the Sturdivant annexation, those two annexations that went through. Both property owners talked about potentially dividing that land through the subdivision standards, but we haven't received an application yet. The Arcadia Drive one, I would say, is further off because they would have to extend water and sewer to get there, which would be.
And they're currently outside the city limits, aren't they? They're in the urban growth boundary.
We annexed the.
Okay, so they're annexed.
Yeah, it was approximately 15 acres on each side. And that was annexed in.
Okay.
And then the Sturdivant one was also annexed in, but that's they're trying to think if there's another lot.
Say, where is that Sturdivant one?
Just north of the elementary school.
North of the elementary school. Okay.
And that one was it was like 6 or 7 acres, somewhere in that range. Yeah.
See, the thing that I have with this is that, you know, these are state recommendations, and what they do, especially when we talk about constrained lands, is our topography in Toledo. And so the topography of Toledo is very, as we all know, is pretty specific. And so these general things that they say would work out in the valley or in Portland, they aren't going to work here.
Yeah, and they. In this case, it was 3J Consulting that helped with it, but they're, you're right that they're, they, I mean, they are based out of Portland. So I think that that's why we kind of can take these recommendations and then kind of run some scenarios to make sure it makes sense before we adopt the code, because you're every single Arcadia lot, the Sturdivant lot, any other larger lot, part of it's going to be constrained. It's, there's almost, there's no way you're going to find a 5-acre flat lot. So, and I think that not every code is so specific.
Just a question. Whatever happened with that apartment complex we were talking about on Sturdivant?
Yeah, so we, the Planning Commission approved it once back in 21, and it got through its 2 years that it could, and it, we, Planning Commission reapproved it in July of 23. So they have a year. Likely they'll request a renewal, but that process is still ongoing. And one of the conditions that we put in there is a wetland delineation to ensure that that parcel didn't have any wetlands. So that's actually kind of what we've been currently working on with the nonprofit to get that complete first. But likely, I would say they'll be coming to the Planning Commission for a 1-year renewal on that application, but they're still, they're not breaking ground right now. We don't have a building permit, but they're still kind of working on the background, getting funding through their funding sources, completing the wetland delineation and other kind of meeting the other conditions as well.
Thank you.
How many of those renewals can they get?
So just currently just one. And that's one thing which we might be able to actually update as part of this partition update, is change that to like an initial 2-year approval with ability to extend another year. Because what we found is there's often, even with partitions and also conditional uses, it takes time to get builders lined up or surveyors lined up. So just recognizing that that takes time, we could increase that initial approval to 2 years instead of 1 year. And that's a good idea to just provide that flexibility, because it, especially with like projects where it is a nonprofit, they have to go to the state for funding or go to other funding sources, and it can take them a lot of time, just how those are set up. And that, and that's, and even like a private developer, sometimes getting things lined up can take longer than a year. So that's definitely an update that could be made to increase that time and allowance. Because it's, we want Planning Commission to be able to review applications and make sure they meet the code. But if they've met the code, you don't want to, if they're cycling back through, because it takes time, it's extra work for staff, extra work for Planning Commission. I'd say overall, that's the goal of all of our code updates, is to provide.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to chase them off.
Yeah.
Not so we'll provide housing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Technology is growing, but not in the right area.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all, that stuff slowed way down.
Well, that was a good question. And so, yeah, other updates, like we have flag lot standards, which I had mentioned in this. There's a couple update suggestions here on kind of how we update those standards. We have very specific standards where the pole of the flag can only be between 100 and 150 feet. Other codes will have it where it's, you have a maximum of 150 feet. And if it's longer than that, you have to have a fire turnaround. Ideally, you don't have a lot of flag lot type development. Another option, which I'd like to build into the code, is kind of creating shared options for shared use driveways. And that those can be better because then you only have one access point for three lots instead of oftentimes if you get three flag lots next to each other, you have three, they try to put three adjacent driveways or something. But if you have the shared access easements, then it's creating a way where it's kind of that one access point instead of multiple access points. And those could work for if it's a longer, say skinny lot and you have a big backyard, you could have a shared access and then have potentially a, two additional homes behind. So that's kind of one of the other ideas of for a code update. And I think I mentioned last time changing partitions from a type 3 to a type 2 approval. So neighbors would still be notified, but it wouldn't have to go to planning commission for approval. But subdivisions, which are more than three lots, would still come to the planning commission because those will typically have a larger impact on the neighboring property owners. And then if there is a case where type 2 gets appealed, it goes to planning commission for review.
I noticed under the, when you were talking about, you have it under 1604 of the access states.
Yeah.
And this kind of goes along with the flag lots and such. But down at the bottom, it says, this may be a low priority for the city as shared access create issues between property who then seek city intervention.
Yeah.
So my question is that avoidable? I mean, what if the city has to intervene, what kettle of fish is that?
Yeah, so it's ideally with those, you create, you require a shared access agreement signed by the property owners.
Okay.
And then that's...
So that's how you would, that's how you would jump ahead to get, take care of the problem ahead of time.
And we could condition that that's provided to the city so that not only is, should it be in their records for each property, but if someone came in and asked questions, we wouldn't be able to intervene, but we would be able to provide, well, with that partition, here's the
easement access agreement where both owners have the right to...
Is it?
I was just thinking that sounds like it could be.
No, we would definitely want to make sure that there's.
Okay. Yeah, that would be the extent of our intervention.
Okay.
Is up front.
Yeah. Here's the data, work it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, because even if it's not a current partition, we get property owners coming in asking questions about access because there are historic lots that one house might be behind another that doesn't have frontage.
Yeah.
And there maybe was never an easement recorded or, and we're, what we can do is we can show them how to search for easements, but we can't provide kind of that intervention. But this is a way where, you would have a legal easement that's created as part of it to prevent any sort of future disagreement, I guess. I mean, there might still be disagreement, but
always are.
Yeah.
It's my last job.
Yeah, but that's.
They need to go get their own attorneys.
Oh yeah.
Fight it out with prescriptive easements.
Yeah, the next meeting it won't probably be that full code section, but we'll have some sections where we're starting to have text edits where you can kind of see where we're proposing changes. Or if you're kind of reading through the code and think some language doesn't make sense, we can look at how do we correct that. And that's kind of where we'll go from here.
Sounds good. So we'll go over all these other ones because a lot of them do sound really good. And just as we get there, we'll fit them in.
Yeah, and I'll
okay.
Try and build in where it's kind of as we go through those text edits, try and relate it back to, well, this is what was recommended or based on the code audit or something along that line, those lines. Not making random changes. They're based in kind of.
No, it's interesting to compare what the thing like family, you know, the definition of family and things like
that.
Yeah. Curious or incurious?
We have a rabbit hole.
So that sounds like you have extended your knowledge as far as you want to go this evening on that. Any discussion items, updates, and reports?
So I guess we did say at the last meeting we would, when Mike was here, we'd provide more details on Radio Court.
Right.
These are questions came up at the last meeting.
Yeah, one thing here that kind of was specific to that also.
After that, I've got a question too.
17th. I guess well, Mike looks some stuff up. The update was that the property owner did come in to get the permit, but he still hasn't submitted the permit. But then on the legal side, there was something that was recorded, and Mike can kind of go over it, which had specific conditions that have to be kind of met.
So Mike kind of recorded a document, drafted a document, this declaration of conditions and restrictions, notice a temporary permit issued, declaration of permit conditions and irrevocable, petition for public improvements. Basically saying that it was a temporary driveway access permit for the access from Business Highway 20 onto the property for construction purposes. And now that the construction's complete, the driveway must be removed or a permitted access permit could be issued pursuant to DMC 1748030. Or the driveway needs to be removed no later than December 15, 2023. Kind of specified the typical culvert installation size that Public Works got from the county, and specified the TMC code provision that says that an owner's responsible for the access drive for the culvert under the access drive. I didn't say that sentence very well, but I think you got what I meant. And then that petition for public improvements needs to be signed. So I just, it was recorded to put people on notice.
Okay.
So it'll ding in the title company does a search and somebody will be on notice. We just felt like that was needed. And I don't think the code enforcement, although I've sent this to him and talked to him, the code enforcement officer hasn't tried to, you know, remove the driveway or else at this point.
Has there been any notifications to him at all?
What's that?
Has Ron got a hold of him at all?
I'm not sure. I think he has talked to him some, but I don't know that it's
specific. I think most of the city's holding their breath, waiting and watching.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed that I read it in that the reason they had to put the garage in because of the those packs that
handle, you know, CCNR.
Yeah,
they did.
Yeah,
I think there's so there's covenants. Sometimes when you do a subdivision, it's homeowners. It's where you get homeowners associations. Record covenants, conditions, restrictions, and so in that subdivision, nobody can have a pink or purple house, and you have to put in a garage a certain size, and you have to
you know, you name it, you can make it up and put it in the CC&Rs because I've drafted them, even though I don't really like them.
Yeah.
And without a homeowners association, without giving you legal advice, hypothetically, the remedy is the other property owner sues to enforce the CC&Rs. It's kind of how that plays out down the road. So he put in a broach and he was required to by the CC&Rs.
So bottom line, he's got to move that driveway off Highway 20.
Bottom line is he's got to either put a culvert in it, a 12-inch.
Does he have to do both?
Well, he either has to remove it or he has to come in and get a permanent access permit from us. And part of that permanent access permit will be him putting in a 12-foot culvert of corrugated plastic.
So you're saying he would be approved to have a permit?
Once he gets
the according to the TMC, yeah, I think he could if he...
And he got that by inside knowledge from working here?
No. No, he got a temporary permit.
But I mean, he knew about how to go around that by working here?
I don't know that he did.
Nobody else was.
I think he became a victim of CCRs, just if I was to just shoot something in the wind.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't part of discussions up front. I don't know what.
So in the paperwork, though, right now, he's supposed to renew that.
Well, that's what I said in this conditions and restrictions, which he actually received about that time or after. I don't think I sent it to him when I first recorded it.
So if he has to remove that driveway, he's got no way to get in that property.
Really. Through his garage. Mm-hmm.
Through Radio Court. Driveway.
Through the garage.
Through the garage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good thinking.
Yeah, that's it. That's his yard there in the back area.
Yeah.
So
the garage faces.
I know that everybody's not happy with. Some people seem to be unhappy with the development.
Well, we've been burned many times here from that kind of same situation in Toledo.
And I think you look at the code, and he met the code as far as the setbacks and all of that when the land use was approved. I don't think he got any kind of special treatment. Whether he knew that he needed to put in the culvert and didn't when he put in that temporary road, I don't know.
So it'll be interesting. So we're just gonna... They've been on notice, and it's just a really unfortunate situation that people, the main thing people are concerned about myself is just the safety of people.
Well, and it's also been as part of the permanent access permit, it's got to be at a T. It can't be at an angle.
Yeah.
So.
It's like the bridges, when they start to build the bridges and they stop them halfway. They did that in San Francisco. You could go, there it was, and it stopped. Bridge to nowhere. There's an off ramp, and it stopped it. Yeah.
No, it's
okay.
Anyway, well, hoping that...
It's an unfortunate ongoing story. Hopefully it'll...
But I'm just giving you the facts of what was in that recorded document. I'm looking at it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hopefully it'll... Yeah. Not a nice way to end the meeting, but it's reality. So On that happy note, are there any comments from commissioners? Ricky, you have one this yet?
No, I've forgotten what it was.
Oh, well, darn you. Okay. Well, before we forget where we're heading home, we shall adjourn the meeting, and everybody is safe next month. That must have been passed.
Yeah.